So, good Friday morning to you.
Not that it's Good Friday, that was a couple months ago, but
it's
still a Good Friday, and I hope that you all have been blessed and enriched by your time here at the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. I myself have been caring for a sick teenager the last couple of days, and so the first lecture I actually got to hear was Jeff Walling's last night, which of course made me think I should cancel my class and not try to be a teacher. So, that's where I'm coming from right now. So today's class, I kind of look at this session as sort of lighter fare for you on a Friday morning, kind of your Saturday morning cartoons a day early, perhaps. And I'm really kind of torn in two directions about this class, and so I'm going to ask you to decide where this class is going to go, because there's two ways this class could go. Obviously, the topic that I'm prepared to talk about is Noah movies about Noah and the flood in Genesis 6 through 9. And, of course, the title of the class alludes to the most recent Noah film, the 2014 Darren Aronofsky film with Russell Crowe as Noah. But that's just the most recent film in a long line of Noah films. So I want to give you a choice in just a minute about which direction we go. But first, let me say up front and admit right up front, I am a biblical scholar. I am not a film critic. Although there is a Christopher Hurd who is a film critic, that is not me. He specializes in writing biographies of actors and entertainers. I specialize in writing about ambiguities in the Hebrew text of Genesis. So we are not the same person, but I'm going to try to do some linking of the Bible and film today. So my interest really in getting into this area is in seeing how filmmakers use their source material. And this will not be a is the book better than the movie argument. If you've had those arguments about, you know, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Age of Ultron, I hope you haven't had it about 50 Shades of Grey. If you've had those arguments, you know, fine, but this is not that class. So there's a long tradition of Noah movies and shorts going all the way back to 1909. As far as I know, the earliest Noah movie was a short in 1909. And I said there were two ways this class can go. We can go the route of my prepared lecture, or we can go the route of a more sort of free-form ad lib discussion, depending on your particular interests. So I can either give you a sort of an academic lecture about the relationship between three of these films and the way they portray Noah and the way they portray the world. And that would be the silent 1928 Noah's Ark, an animated film from Argentina that came out in 2007, and the most recent Noah movie in 2014. So I have a lecture prepared that delves into some of the details of these and relates it to some of the details in the Noah story of the Bible. The other thing I can do, and this would be totally ad lib, but I just got to kind of feeling uneasy about the fact that it was kind of an academic lecture, is I could give you a sort of a brief history of Noah movies kind of off the cuff, and then we can have a more free-flowing discussion about Noah films, particularly if you happen to have questions that you want to address about different Noah films. So which direction do you want to go on this? Do you want to hear me delving into... There's lots of film clips in that one, and I have to talk really fast. But do you want to hear me dive deep, or do you want... Shallow or deep is really the...
Deep.
You know, deep with fewer questions? Okay. All right, so let's do that. So here's the question that I'm really sort of asking about these movies in this particular presentation. You obviously can't examine every detail of all the films. So what I'm really focused on here is the way that the filmmakers portray the state of the world that causes God to want to send the flood, and the character of Noah that prompts God to save Noah. And we'll need to look first at how this unfolds in the Bible, and then we'll look at how this unfolds in the films. So before we get into this, I need to share with you a little bit of technical information that comes out of 100, 150 years of biblical studies, and it's kind of become commonplace in scholarship, but I don't know how much it has transmitted out to the public, at least the public that doesn't watch the History Channel. So the Genesis story in the flood story, rather, in the book of Genesis, chapter 6 through 9, is kind of like a bowl of orange vanilla swirl frozen yogurt. And I hope that doesn't make anybody want to bail on the class and go get frozen yogurt. But there are two flavors or two strands in this story that are twisted together, that alternate. And you can't, if you separate them, you destroy the dessert, but you can still taste the individual flavors. All right, it's kind of like what you get at Christmas. You know, in December, we often get Christmas pageants that include elements from both Matthew and Luke, and you can't always tell where one is beginning and one is ending in the greatest Christmas pageant ever at your church. But in the book of Genesis, it's like this has already been done for us. So I'm going to call these the Lord strand and the God strand, and that those names are based on the name that is used for the deity. And you can see these alternating in certain paragraphs within Genesis 6 through 9. Now, I'm going to be focused on Genesis 6 because that is where the narrator tells us about the state of the world and about the initial state of Noah, and I'm not really going to go too much into the actual, you know, flooding and all that stuff itself. So, some basic information about these two real quickly. The Lord strand is the first one we encounter in Genesis chapter 6, verses 5 through 8, and you can see I've highlighted the word Lord there, so you can see why I'm calling it the Lord strand. And so this is where we learn from the Lord strand about Noah's character and about the character of the world. And the character of the world is described using the word wickedness and evil. Now, if you were listening closely, you think I just made a grammatical error, but I didn't. These are both the same word in Hebrew. In my English translation, the NRSV, the KJV, that whole family of traditions, we get two different words. But this represents the same Hebrew word. And this Hebrew word, which is pronounced ra, you got to get that at the end or it's a different word. This implies moral evil, typically. It can also imply other things, but in this particular case, it implies moral evil because it's talking about the inclination of the human heart. So this paragraph attributes the reason God decides to flood the world is because humans have become morally evil through and through. Now, what about Noah? Noah is described here as having found favor in the sight of the Lord. He found favor in the sight of the Lord. The King James Version is actually a better translation here. He found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And that implies that the reason Noah is saved has nothing to do with Noah and everything to do with God. And in fact, there's a compilation of rabbinic interpretations from the Roman era. It's called Genesis Rabbah. And in Genesis Rabbah, there is a comment that Noah was saved not because he had any merit. In fact, one of the rabbis says Noah had less than an ounce of merit. But he was saved only because God is righteous, not because Noah was righteous. Now, that may be a little bit shocking to hear because that's not the way we're used to thinking about Noah. And the reason we're used to thinking about Noah differently is because of the next paragraph, which is the God strand in Genesis 6, 9 through 13. So I've highlighted God there so you can see why I call it the God strand. And Noah is described at the beginning of this paragraph as a righteous man, blameless in his generation, somebody who walks with God. Now, the rabbis were even a little nervous about that blameless in his generation, and they spent a lot of time talking about what in his generation means. Does that mean that he's only righteous in comparison to the other people alive at that time? Or he would be even more righteous if he had righteous friends to help him be righteous? But there's clearly a contrast in this paragraph between Noah and everybody else. Noah is different somehow. He's not participating in whatever it is that is causing the world's problems at this time. Now, I have to spend just a little more, go into a little more depth about what the world's problem is in this paragraph. The problem is, according to verses 11 and 12, that the earth was corrupt because all flesh had corrupted its way on the earth. And you can see the word corrupt from the NRSV translation highlighted there. Now, this word corrupt, in Hebrew, it's shachat, and I'm going to have to use that word occasionally to let you know that it's the same word. So this word can go kind of in two different ways. If you look it up in the dictionaries, you'll find out that it can mean kind of two different things. It can refer to causing damage or to the damage that is thus caused on the one hand, or it can refer to moral evil on the other hand. And so we have to kind of figure out what does it mean in this paragraph. And in this particular paragraph, I am pretty well convinced that it means damage and or the damage that is caused by damaging acts. And the reason I believe that about this paragraph is because verse 13 says, that this is what God is going to do to the world, except that our English translations obscure this by translating it differently. Same word, different translation in verse 13. This is the NRSV, which is a direct descendant of the KJV. So I went back, looked at the KJV, same thing. Corrupt, 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 destroy. Same verb, though. And so we know from the bigger story that God doesn't intend to make people more evil, right? What God intends to do in this story is damage and destroy. And so I'm kind of using that as a control for what this means. So in this paragraph, it seems that the emphasis is on the damage that has been done to the world by, quote, all flesh, twice repeated right there, all flesh. And there's a word, there's another word in here that reinforces that impression for me. It's the word violence here, which also means either the act of being violent or the violence that results, the harm that results from somebody being violent. So here the emphasis in the God strand is on Noah being totally different from everybody else, and everybody else is responsible for damaging things, damaging the world, damaging each other. Right, so with that in mind, there is another translation that I'll just put up here real quickly. This is from a gentleman named Everett Fox, a Jewish scholar, who is the only person I have found who, in a published translation, translates this consistently, and he uses forms of the word ruin. So the world has gone to ruin because all flesh has ruined its way, and God is going to bring ruin on the earth, and that helps us see the word repetition there and the theme that we are talking about here. So let's get into the films. If you're going to put Noah on film, you've got to find a way to portray the state of the world that causes God to want to bring the flood in the first place, and you've got to find a way to portray Noah. Otherwise, you have no film, right? So let's start with, how are you going to do this? Let's start with the 1928 silent talkie hybrid Noah's Ark. It's directed by a gentleman who's in the United States, goes by the name Michael Curtiz. He has another name, an Eastern European name that I don't know how to pronounce properly. So I'll stick with Michael Curtiz as he is billed. As he is billed in the materials from this period. So the Noah's Ark movie, in the silent movie era, when they had the big biblical epics in the silent movie era, they tended to be what are called frame stories, which means that the movie's really a modern story, and there's a biblical story embedded somewhere in the modern story that serves as a commentary on the modern story. So in the case of the Noah's Ark film, the modern story is about these two doughboys in World War I. And it takes them from the beginning of the war to the signing of the armistice. So what we're going to see right now, and there's going to be lots of clips with little comments from me in between from this point onward. What we're going to see right now is the transition from the modern story where there's a group of people they're in a building that's just been shelled, and they're kind of buried alive in this building. And we're going to see the transition over to the Noah's Ark story as a way of showing us how this film portrays the state of the world around Noah that causes God to want to bring the flood. And I'm hopeful that our sound will work properly. Yes, yes, there we go. This, of course, is a silent movie, so it's not really silent, there's a soundtrack. So what's wrong with the world of Noah's generation? It's a world of lust. What's wrong with the world of 1914? It's a world of hate. Genesis 6:5. Although they've put the word God in there instead of the Lord, which is what's in the original. This is all made up. those places are real, but the rest of it. So there's no such person as King Nephilim or the false god Jaguth, but in this particular movie, so how do you portray the state of the world at the time that God decides to bring the flood? They described it as a world of lust, and you haven't really kind of seen that on screen. So there's really two things. One is moral turpitude, and the other is pagan worship. All right, so we've got the false god Jaguth, and we've got the world of lust, and that is how this particular film portrays the world at the time of Noah, and most Noah films ever since have followed suit. Now, I'm setting aside those that are just using the ark as kind of a backdrop for silly animal antics, like, you know, some Walt Disney stuff. Those that try to adapt the whole story, that's kind of the direction they have taken. Now, I think the film that does this the most concisely is this 2007 animated film, which was originally aired in Buenos Aires, and this is an English dub, obviously, or not Buenos Aires, but Argentina. I first learned about it in Buenos Aires. And it's directed by Juan Pablo Buscarini, who's kind of an Argentine-Italian director, and he's able to capture that whole idea of moral turpitude in less than 65 seconds. So here's how he does it. So the peacock exhibits pride, envy, greed, sloth, lust, gluttony, anger. All right, so in less than 65 seconds, he's given you a vignette of all seven deadly sins. All right, and this is the way that this particular film shows you that the world is bad. I mean, there's other things, too, that people will do that are bad. It is significant that six out of the seven deadly sins are acted out by animals here, and we'll come back to that point, actually, a little bit later on. Now, the most recent Noah film, the 2014 film written by Ari Handel, directed by Darren Aronofsky, starring Russell Crowe as Noah, takes a completely different approach to showing what's wrong with the world. And in this particular movie, Aronofsky shows the problems with the world primarily through non-sacral violence. What I mean by non-sacral violence is it's not pagan worship, it's not virgin sacrifice, it's just violence, just people being violent, but it's a special kind of violence. It specifically is predation, is preying on one person or preying on another person or on other things. So he shows it in, there's really three types of violence that are key in this movie. One is human-on-human violence, and you see that from the very beginning when, have any of y'all seen that movie? Some of you have seen that movie. So you see it right at the very, very beginning of that movie when Tubal-Cain kills Noah's father, Lamech. There's human-on-animal violence, which you see right after the title card when there's some hunters who kill the little Dirosaurus or whatever it is. And there's human-on-planet violence, which is primarily shown through all the references to strip mining for this mineral called Sohar. So I'm about to show you a clip that is super disturbing. It's about 2 minutes long. It's really, really dark. It captures the tone of the movie pretty well, I think. But it also puts on display the human-on-human predation and the human-on-animal predation. The mineral predation is not going to really show up in this particular clip. But this clip, I think, sets the tone for what's wrong with the world or why the world has gone wrong in this particular film. So steel yourselves. This is pretty bloody if you haven't seen it before. There's Russell Crowe as Noah.
You! You!
So if it was unclear what's happening there, you've got a guy in the camp who's trading two girls for meat. And then they throw that calf out, everybody dives into it, starts eating it raw, and Noah has his Luke Skywalker in the Dagobah cave moment where he sees himself chawing down on this raw meat, and it obviously is transitioning into a vision at this point. So the world in which Aronofsky's Noah lives, in which Russell Crowe's Noah lives, is a world that has been ruined. Right, and really, basically, what Aronofsky is doing here is he is emphasizing that second paragraph that we saw before. Most of the other films emphasize the what I call the Lord strand, where human evil is the main problem. Aronofsky in this film emphasizes what I call the God strand, where the main problem is the damage that has been done to the world by various actors. In we'll get into that more in just a minute. Now, the snake you saw and the fruit obviously refers to the Garden of Eden story, and the upraised rock, in case you didn't catch that, also refers to the Cain and Abel story. That'll become more clear in other parts of the film. But these are the ways, these two images keep coming up throughout the film, and they're Aronofsky's ways of kind of reminding the viewer that the world is ruined and has been ruined from a long time back. So it's a way of connecting Genesis 6, the beginning of the Noah story, with Genesis 3:17, cursed is the ground because of you, Adam. And Aronofsky takes that verse super seriously in the way that he depicts the world. Cursed is the ground because of Adam. And then also Genesis 4:11, cursed are you, Cain, from the ground. You're alienated from the land because of murdering your brother. And Aronofsky, for him, those two verses, and then the second paragraph that we saw of the Noah story, those are the things that he uses to construct his vision of what Noah's world is like. So he's clearly emphasizing that God strand paragraph, whereas most other films emphasize the other paragraph. So for Aronofsky's film, the problem in this film, as he sees it, the way you depict the world, the problem that the world has that causes God to bring the flood, is predation run amok. Predatory behavior out of control. And so the way that you depict Noah's righteousness in this film is by showing him as being opposed to predatory behavior. And the place where you see that, I think, where you first see that, is in the very first scene after the title card. So this title comes up, and then you immediately go into this next scene. And I'm going to let it play, but it kind of works and it kind of doesn't. I think this is where the movie really starts to run off the rails, which is sad because it's like, you know, 4 minutes in. There's your Dyrasaurus. Also notice this kind of scorched earth landscape. All right, so this Noah thinks it is justice to kill three humans because they killed that little dog thingy in search of meat. And essentially, what you learn, the very first thing you learn about this Noah as an adult, is that he hates people. And he is afraid of people. He's a misanthrope. And scenes like that are the reason why one particularly bitter critic called this particular Noah an environmentalist wacko. Now, that critic said a lot of things that really, I think, don't hold up. However, Aronofsky does paint Noah into a corner from the very beginning. And I'm going to try to develop that point here, but it's going to take a little while to get to the end. The problem that I see here developing already in this early scene is that Noah in the film, in this film, in the Aronofsky film, draws this very sharp distinction between humans and animals. So you have the setting from the God strand where the problem is the damage that has been caused to the world. But in that paragraph, the problem has been caused by all flesh. Not by human flesh, by all flesh. But in the movie, it's just humans that bear responsibility for predation. And I think that is going to become a problem later on. Now, it's clear that this particular Noah is a very deeply scarred, deeply flawed, dark protagonist, and of course he is. He's in a Darren Aronofsky film. So you can't get around that. But he nevertheless is narrowing the scope of where that paragraph in the Bible puts the blame. And I think we're going to see that is a problem. Now, contrasting that Noah with the Noah from El Arca, I think, is pretty revealing. So the Noah in this film, I think the Noah in this film is much more of an environmentalist than the Noah in the Aronofsky film. And in fact, that the headline, you know, in the Buenos Aires newspaper read, "Noah was the first conservationist." That was the headline when this movie was released. But nobody, you know, then went wacko and thought it was a totally non-Christian film because of it. But here's the way he's portrayed at one point when he tries to protect animals from human predation.
Until we reach our destination.
Then what are we supposed to eat in the meantime?
Whatever God provides will be enough.
Right, so this guy is anti-predation as well, trying to protect that goose. But the difference is that this Noah thinks that humans deserve as much protection as geese. So here is the next scene after the title card.
Good morning. With this, you finish paying off what you owe me.
But Farfan, you had said that with the last delivery, the debt had been satisfied.
But the price of grain has gone down.
What's important now is that it's paid in full, and you can get back in debt again.
Shouldn't we do it at night?
That's God, and that's his angel.
Do you want me to take charge of the arrangements? I'll take care of everything.
Thank you, Noah. Thank you very much. Thank you. Oh, sorry.
I don't know if you caught what just happened there, but Noah just went back into debt to free a slave.
Father, we have to talk. Every year we work harder, and each time we get paid even less.
Yeah, the land becomes more and more barren.
So it's Japheth that's
paying for it.
We're not doing things right.
Have we bothered anyone? Have we hurt anybody? Is anybody suffering on account of us?
No.
No.
Well, then we're not doing so badly.
All right, so that's a Noah you can like, right? This is a Noah who's equally protective of humans and animals and all living creatures. And so basically in this movie, what we have is almost the opposite of the Aronofsky movie. What we've got in the Aronofsky movie is we've got a Noah from the first paragraph who has not an ounce of merit, and you have the world from the second paragraph where people and... Well, all right, so it's a modified form of the world from the second paragraph where the world has been damaged. In this movie, you have the opposite. You have the world from the first paragraph, where the primary problem is human immorality, and you have the Noah from the second paragraph, who's an upright guy who stands in contrast to everybody else around him and exhibits morality and godliness and so forth. Now, Aronofsky, I think, takes the second paragraph more seriously, though, the language of the world's ruin, more seriously than any other film that I have seen. You saw that in the blasted earth, the scorched earth landscape. But I think, and I've hinted at this already, but I think the problem that really sort of confounds Aronofsky in the way he tells this movie, and I said he paints Noah into a corner, and I think the reason he does that is partially by ignoring, he emphasizes the ruin in the second paragraph, he ignores the all flesh in the second paragraph, and he pulls the humanity focus from the first paragraph. And so Noah, in this film, blames, and Aronofsky, by extension, blames all the world's problems on people. All the predation, all the problems of the world on people. So before, and there's a movement in the film, before he builds the ark, Noah seems to hold out some hope for humanity, as you'll see in this little clip.
Men are going to be punished for what they've done to this world. There will be destruction. There will be tragedy. Our family has been chosen for a great task. We've been chosen to save the innocent.
The innocent?
The animals.
Why an innocent?
Because they still live as they did in God.
We need to save nothing. Start again.
But what of us?
I guess we get to start again too. We get to start again in a new battle world.
All right, so we get to start again. He's got a little bit of hope there, but notice still, everything's on people. The animals are innocent. Right? Now, there is actually a more sort of sophisticated take on this, I think, in Buscarini's film, because Buscarini takes all flesh seriously in the second paragraph, because this film recognizes that animal-on-animal predation is part of the problem that you have in that second paragraph, and that it's still going to be a problem aboard the ark and after the ark, especially when you have anthropomorphic animals who can walk around and have nightclubs and stuff like that. So here's a little clip illustrating that.
Your Majesty, I'm sorry to distract you from important matters, but the animals would like to know if they're allowed to feast on each other during the trip.
I need to have my bacon for breakfast, you know. One less piggy won't make much of a difference, will it?
I think that...
We need a decision, Your Majesty.
Maybe we ought to listen to some other opinions?
I totally agree. Will it bother anyone if I express my opinion with my mouth?
Wow. This is not the time for internal conflicts that sooner or later end badly. We have the opportunity to forge a new world. Let's do it based on respect and tolerance. I say here that if any of us so much as touches one of our brothers, I myself will give him his rightful punishment.
All right, now you're savvy movie watchers. You've already figured out that the tiger's not serious. So they negotiate this non-predation pact before they get on the ark, and then the tiger and his cronies try to frame the lion for breaking the non-predation pact. While they're on the ark, that's his way of trying to seize power. Now back to Aronofsky's film. By the time we get to the actual flooding, by the time the actual flooding starts, Russell Crowe's Noah has become convinced that what the Creator wants after the flood is a world without people. And so this is the way he explains it to his family after they get on the ark.
Let me tell you a story. The first story my father told me and the first story that I told each of you. In the beginning, there was nothing. Nothing but the silence of an infinite darkness. face of the void, whispering, "Let there be light." And light was. And it was good. The first day. And then the formless light began to take on substance, shape. The second day. And our world was born. Our beautiful, fragile home. And a great warming light nurtured its days. And a lesser light ruled the nights. And there was evening. And morning. Another day. And the waters of the world gathered together. And in their midst emerged dry land. Another day passed. And the ground put forth the growing things, a thick blanket of green stretching across all creation. And the waters, too, teemed with life. Great creatures of the deep that are no more. Vast multitudes of fish, some of which may still swim beneath these seas. And soon, the sky was streaming with birds. And there was evening. And there was morning. A fifth day. Now the whole world was full of living beings. Everything that creeps. Everything that crawls. And every beast that walks upon the ground. And it was good. It was all good. There was light and air and water and soil. All clean and unspoiled. The plants and fish, the fowl and beast. Each after their own kind. All part of the great whole. All in their place. And all was in balance. It was paradise. The jewel in the Creator's palm. And the Creator made man. And by his side boy. Father and mother of us all. He gave them a choice. Follow the temptation of darkness. Or hold on to the blessing of light. They ate from a forbidden fruit. Their innocence is extinguished. And so for the 10 generations since Adam's sin has walked within us. Brother against nation against nation. Man against creation. We murdered each other. We broke the wall. We did this. Man did this. Everything that was beautiful, everything that was good, we shattered. Now, it begins again. Air, water, earth, plant, fish, bird, and beast. Paradise returns. But this time there will be no men. If we were to enter the garden again, it would only be to destroy it once more. No. The Creator has judged us. Mankind must end.
About 90 seconds later, he'll say that without humanity in this new paradise, that all the other creatures will be safe. All the other creatures will be safe. So this is the blind spot, I think, in this movie, which sort of again, turns this Noah into a sort of people-hating people, a misanthrope who can't project the problems that animals are going to have after the fact. So there's some really powerful stuff there about, this is really funny, because this is a film made by a guy of Jewish heritage who is agnostic at best, and it is thoroughly Calvinistic. With the original sin and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, that's a side point. The point is, it's really hard to blame animal on animal predation on things that people have done. All right. Genesis 3 in the curse section, that doesn't give you any warrant for blaming that on Adam. There's no warrant for blaming that on Cain. And in the Noah story itself, that second paragraph, it's all flesh. It's not human flesh. It's all flesh that has corrupted its way on the world. Now, Buscarini recognizes that and struggles with it. This is during the voyage.
Why don't we just kill them now?
Of course. I don't see why we have to worry about that foolish lion and his stupid friends.
I can see that fat has weakened your poor carrion-fed brains. Aren't you aware that we've earned the respect of all the animals on board this ark?
And why would we want the herbivores' respect? Are they at all worried about not having a lettuce's respect?
You imbeciles! The world to come will have new rules. Aren't you tired of having to run after your food? We won't have to do that anymore. The food will run to us. When we get to dry land, we will take the animals to a place where we can choose the ones we want.
All right, so clearly he's kind of channeling Upton Sinclair at this point, and I see that I'm getting really, really close to time here. But, I mean, it raises a really serious question. Is Noah saving the pigs just so they can feed the tigers later on, right? Animal predation, animal-on-animal predation is still going to be a problem after the flood. And this really raises, to me, what is one of the most disturbing things about the flood story is that the flood doesn't seem to work. In other words, it does work in terms of resetting things and killing a bunch of people and killing a bunch of animals, but the human heart afterward doesn't really change. And the animal behavior afterward doesn't really change. And the story is quite explicit about that. Genesis 8:21, which is part of the Lord's strand, says the inclination of the human heart is only evil from youth. And that's after the flood. And then in chapter 9, you get what appears to be the institution of capital punishment for murder, which applies in the text, not just to humans, but also to animals. So the problem of predation is still there in the text after the flood. Buscarini's film recognizes that. Aronofsky's film really doesn't recognize that, doesn't deal with it, and I think that blind spot really hampers the whole film. Trying to blame everything on humanity, it just flat doesn't work. And it makes Noah this horrible character that you really can't stand, who tries to kill his own granddaughters on the ark later on. Now we're down to like 1 minute left in our budgeted time, so I don't have time to show the other clips that I had prepared. I spent so much time last night trimming the clips and trimming the clips and trimming. It didn't work. But let me go back to the 1928 silent for a minute, because I think this is really an interesting point. I'll try to just summarize it in about 30, 45 seconds here. So the movie actually starts at the end. The movie actually starts with the rainbow. And Noah is worshiping, and the rainbow comes up. And then it says, but, people were still bad. And then it goes to the Tower of Babel, and then it goes to the Golden Calf, and then it goes to Wall Street, and this was made in 1928. And it goes to Las Vegas. And it talks about greed making people violent and killing each other over money. And then it goes into to World War I. And then at the end, that preacher says, that the flood of water is a parallel to the flood of blood across Europe. And then he says at the very end, when they learn that the armistice has been signed, he says, "This is the beginning of the rainbow of God's new covenant of peace." And the other main character, played by George O'Brien, says, "Do you mean there won't be any more war?" And the preacher says, "I mean that war itself is now an outlaw and will be hunted to extinction." Yeah, this is 1928, about halfway between the war to end all wars and the next big war after that. Mm-hmm. Right. So you would think, didn't they get the prologue of their own movie? That flood of water, you still have the same problems after the flood. Perhaps maybe with a little bit more hope in them, but it still is very difficult. So we've run out of time, but let me say, just as a very brief sort of conclusion, that I, out of these three films, in my judgment, it's actually the cartoon that works the best. And it struggles, I think, more, even though there's a lot of fun, there's some irreverence, there's some sexual innuendo in there that I didn't play. There's this one scene in the Spanish version, it's not in the English version you can buy on DVD, where the panther that you might have seen does this nightclub act where she sings "I Will Survive," and it's all about how she's going to eat the herbivores after the flood. But I actually think that this cartoon movie engages a little bit more sophisticated way with the issues that are raised in the text. And these other movies, I think, kind of paint themselves into corners by the analogies that they try to draw. All right, I've got to stop so that people can get to the the next activity. If you want to, if you've got any questions about these movies, I'll be happy to hang around for a few minutes, but I got to leave pretty quickly to take my younger son to state-mandated standardized testing. Yay! All right, so thank you very much. You've been a great audience. I hope you go out and enjoy some Nolan movies.